Welcome to the Pesky Pole Podcast.
Step up to the plate, buddy.
With Michael Dobreski.
If he was manager of the major leagues, he'd be out of town a long time ago.
And here he is, the man who'd walk through hell in a gasoline suit just to make fun of Derek Jeter.
You're mocking me, aren't you?
Michael Dobreski.
Welcome back. It's the Pesky Pole Podcast. I am your host, Michael Dobreski. I am the baseball nerd, and this podcast is for baseball nerds. And this, I guess, is episode 2 or episode 3, depending on how you look at it. We started this podcast originally about 4 years ago and did one episode and then took some time off. You know, what can you say? So we did one last week, and we're doing one this week. That's a good start. Back-to-back weeks, and we look forward to doing many more for you here in the coming weeks in the future with some interviews and things like that. But check out that first episode. The sound quality on that is not great, but it's a great topic in that I have Bruce Spitzer on, and Bruce Spitzer wrote a book called Extra Innings, and it's a book about Ted Williams. Well, kind of. This book is a fictional book. It's a what-if book. What if Ted Williams came back to life in the future? You know, the cryogenics idea. He comes back and he starts his life over again, and he plays baseball. And it deals with the baseball aspect of it, but also more importantly, or not, I guess, importantly, but more interesting, I think, is the personal side. And if you know anything about Ted Williams, he was a great baseball player. He was a war hero. He was a great fly fisherman. But he didn't have the best life when it came to his kids or his wives. He wasn't the best husband or the best father. He was a complicated guy in his personal life. So that the book kind of goes into that detail and whether or not he's going to choose to be the great hitter again, or you know, focus on being maybe a better person, better father, better husband, those things. So, good book. It's an interview with Bruce Spitzer I did a few years back. So check that out. And in the future, we're going to do more interviews like that, more interviews with people who are writing baseball books and things like that. So definitely check that out in the near future. Pesky Pole Podcast, check my blog out, thepeskypole.net, and that's written by me, and we have some cool stuff on there, and we'll have some cool stuff on there in the future, especially during baseball season. Baseball season, I do a lot of stuff where I kind of break down each Red Sox game in terms of projections for the game coming up, and kind of analysis of the game that was just played. So it's stuff for, as I said before, it's for the baseball nerd. It's for a different way of looking at things in that nature. And we're going to have some interviews as well. Also, the 1988 baseball simulation replay for the Red Sox I am doing on my blog, thepeskypole.net, with Out of the Park Baseball. That's up there too. A slight delay in that right now because my laptop that I have the game on is in the shop right now. I had a little issue with the hinge. I'm not sure if you guys ever had this problem. The hinge on my laptop, where it opens and closes, a piece broke off of that. And so when you open it up, the whole screen, the frame of the screen, pulls off. And so I've been dealing with this problem for about 3 months now, but finally it really broke for good. And I had to go and take it to the shop, and I'm hoping I get it back soon. I don't like going through Out of the Park Baseball withdrawal, but that's why there's a delay in those simulations. So check that out for sure on there. And we're going to get to our topics. We got 5 topics today, and we're going with a big one. If you listen to the opening, of course, done by my partner, Rob Sanders, did the opening for me. And, of course, he is my tag team duo on my other podcast, the Rob and Comrade Show, and you can check that out, robandcomrade.com. or in the iTunes store, and that's a podcast that deals with the Gamecocks and the Clemson Tiger rivalry. So it's a rivalry podcast, but coming up, We're going to have an interview on that podcast with Aaron Fitt. Aaron Fitt writes for D1Baseball.com, and we're going to cover some college baseball stuff. So if you're a college baseball fan at all, definitely check that out in the coming weeks. We'll have that preview for it, and always check out the podcast there. I think we do a good job. We kind of go back and forth, Rob and I do, and we argue, and we try to one-up each other sometimes, and it's a great rivalry, and it's a really, really fun podcast to do. So let's kind of get to the topics, and as I said before, in the opening, there's a line in there that I would walk through a hell in a gasoline suit just to make fun of Derek Jeter, and that is true. I do like to make fun of Derek Jeter, and today I kind of get to do that a little bit, and it deals with Chipper Jones. Of course, the big news is Chipper Jones here went to the Hall of Fame. 97% voting result for him, which is pretty unreal, and for Chipper Jones. And Chipper Jones is probably my favorite non-Red Sox player. I moved down south to go to college here at the University of South Carolina back in 1993, and that's when Chipper Jones first made his debut for the Braves. And so the Braves are kind of the hometown team. They're the team on local TV here. And so it was when I moved down here, he kind of began his career. We're similar ages. He's a little bit older, about 2 years older than I was. And so I followed his whole career. You know, when he got old, I was getting old and all those things. And so one of my favorite players, and he's going in the Hall of Fame now, and he'll be going to Cooperstown, which is not far from where my mother lives. And I'm actually thinking about going up there for the inductions in July to see that. But Chipper Jones, you know, there's a great article that was written about him today on ESPN.com. Check that out, the 10 things you should know about Chipper Jones, it's called. And these are things that I don't think many people know about him. Chipper Jones, when you talk about Chipper Jones, you talk about the idea that he's a great hitter, he's a switch hitter, hits for power from both sides, you know, clutch against the Mets, all those things we know about. But no one ever brings up the fact that he's a great leader or a great teammate, all those things. And this is why I bring up Derek Jeter. You know, Jeter has this kind of aura about him that, you know, Jeter had a great career. He's a Hall of Famer. I'm not going to sit there and say he's not a Hall of Famer. But the problem is that when his numbers fall short, when you compare him to other people, and I mean, when you compare him to, you know, guys even in the Yankee lore like DiMaggio or Mantle or Gehrig, and whenever he falls short, the Yankee fans will talk about, well, he was the captain. You know, he's so unselfish. He's a leader. He does everything you could do to win. All he wants to do is win. And that wasn't really the case. You know, I think that's an overblown narrative of Jeter that, one, isn't really true. And I'm not saying he's a bad teammate. What I'm saying is he's like every other baseball player. He has an ego. He thinks of himself first. He wants to win. He wants to win in his terms. And so the biggest kind of fraud, the fraudulent story that goes that Derek Jeter is the ultimate team guy who only cares about winning. And you can kind of boil this down real quickly about Jeter. In 2004, okay, the best shortstop in baseball, Alex Rodriguez, came to the Yankees. Okay, A-Rod, regardless what you feel about him, was coming off a season defensively where he made just 4 errors. And of course, he also was hitting 50 homers a year, 40 homers a year, was a great hitter. He was the best player in the game, okay? And you can make a case for Barry Bonds too. We won't, you know, quite get into that, but A-Rod and Bonds were in that same kind of category. And so he came to the Yankees as the best shortstop in baseball. Derek Jeter defensively was never a great shortstop. I know the web gems and the jump throw, all those things, okay, that make SportsCenter and make you think that he's this great Gold Glove type fielder. But Derek Jeter, if you look at all the statistics and the metrics and defensively, was not a guy with great range. And as he got older, especially. And so he was a pretty average defensive shortstop. And so if Derek Jeter was really about being a captain, okay, being a leader and being the guy that all he wants to do is win, wouldn't you think that he would volunteer to move positions when they acquired A-Rod? I mean, And I don't know if he was asked. I have no idea. I don't know if they told him that A-Rod was coming and he said, I'm not moving. No one's ever really brought that up. But we do know he'd move. And we do know if he went to Joe Torre and said, hey, Mr. Torre, Joe, I think I should move because we got the best shortstop in baseball, he would have moved because obviously it makes more sense for A-Rod to play shortstop than for Jeter to play shortstop. But Derek Jeter wanted to be the shortstop. Okay, the shortstop position for the Yankees is a very prestigious kind of position, and he wanted to be known as a shortstop. And so, once again, everyone talks about the fact that he wants to win more than anything else. Yes, he wants to win, but he wants to win on his terms. He wants to win with himself being a shortstop. Now, also going into that idea is that him and A-Rod had a falling out a few years earlier when A-Rod had that article that he interview he gave where he basically said that, you know, I forgot the exact wording he was, but he basically insinuated that Derek Jeter has a much easier job because he's surrounded by all these great players, and so they pitch to him and he gets good pitches to hit because, you know, of that reason. And those, by the way, is a true statement. It's not anything that is, you know, groundbreaking. What was groundbreaking about it was that A-Rod and Jeter were really good friends at the time, and he kind of said that. And Jeter kind of, you know, didn't like that, and they had a falling out. And so when A-Rod got to the Yankees' point, Jeter already had his kind of nose out of shape, and he was intent on making A-Rod's adjustment to New York as hard as possible. Now, once again, the narrative is that Derek Jeter is the greatest, you know, team player, captain, you know, and all that stuff. And that's not true. A-Rod had to learn third base and also had to adjust to New York, and he struggled. And I'll tell you right now, the Red Sox don't win the World Series in 04 if A-Rod is the shortstop on opening day. If Derek Jeter really was a captain who cared about winning and took A-Rod under his wing and tried to make A-Rod's transition easier, the Red Sox don't win that. And you look at the fact that A-Rod was getting booed at some point, and, you know, the Yankee fans could almost sense the fact that Jeter and A-Rod didn't get along. And the Yankee fans, of course, side with Jeter, so A-Rod was being booed. And when Derek Jeter was asked about it, you know, in an interview with about the fans booing him, his response was, it's not my job to tell the fans whether or not to boo. Okay, well, here's the funny thing, though. A few years earlier, when Jason Giambi first came over, I forgot what year now, was it 02 or 03, remember the year before, when Giambi came over and Giambi was struggling a little bit with the Yankees and the Yankee fans were booing him, and Derek Jeter made it publicly known. He came out and said to the Yankee fans to stop booing him. That doesn't, you know, that he's trying hard and all this stuff here. And so then just a year or two later, same situation, suddenly it's not his job. So Derek Jeter secretly probably liked the idea he was getting booed. He liked the idea that A-Rod was struggling, okay? And so the whole, once again, I think we have to be careful on that. So back to Chipper Jones now. So Chipper Jones, you just talk about his numbers. You just talk about what a great player he is. You don't talk about his captain leadership. In the article on ESPN.com, it talks about how he would sit there and look at people on his teammates' swings and their approaches, and help them out. And not in a way in which he would call them out in front of the teammates. He would do it in private. He would kind of come over in a non-threatening way, a non-judgmental way, and just say, you know, hey, you know, on that approach right there, the pitcher, you know, there's one situation where Brian McCann struck out on three split-finger fastballs, and he asked, you know, Brian McCann, listen, this pitcher's best pitch is a split-finger fastball. So what do you think you're going to get in that situation late in the game? And McCann goes, his split-finger fastball. He goes, exactly. He's only going to throw that pitch. You have to look for it. David Ross, he helped out with just how he was loading his back leg and his swing. And he would do these little things to help out guys just because that's who he was. In 2002, the Braves went out and got Vinny Castilla as a free agent. The only problem was Vinny Castilla played third base. Chipper Jones also played third base. Now, Chipper Jones is a lot like Jeter in that defensively, you know, Chipper wasn't the greatest third baseman in the world. He's pretty average defensively. He wasn't bad, but he wasn't great. He wasn't Brooks Robinson. He wasn't Mike Schmidt defensively. And so when they got Vinny Castilla, You know, Chipper Jones said, you know, gave the go-ahead to go get him and said, I'll play left field. And so, you know, Chipper Jones played some left field when he was younger, played some outfield before, but it wasn't a spot he was comfortable playing, but he didn't care. He knew that by him switching to the outfield, it made the Braves better. It made them better defensively at third base and made their lineup better, like it made their lineup deeper. And so those things don't get talked about with Chipper Jones. But with Derek Jeter, people bring up his captaincy and his leadership, yet there's no real proof of that. There's lots of proof against that. And so I just kind of find that funny on there with that. So that's kind of my Derek Jeter take and my Chipper Jones take. Some funny stories, though, about Chipper Jones. My favorite story about Chipper Jones, besides moving positions there, was he told this story when he was being interviewed, I think early in the year, about Greg Maddux. And this happened, I think, in Chipper's rookie year in 95 or so. And Chipper Jones was starting to kind of get hot and starting to kind of live up to that potential and start to live up to the hype he was getting. And, you know, Greg Maddux kind of did something, you know, kind of a funny joke on him here. And so what happened was, as Chipper tells the story, that Chipper Jones goes into the shower. And he is showering, you know, and Greg Maddux walks up to him in the shower as well and starts talking to Chipper about his approach to the plate and kind of what he sees from pitchers. And Chipper Jones tells the story, says, I really think I'm a young kid, and Greg Maddux, his great pitcher, is asking me for my insight, and I really feel like I made it finally. And so, you know, Chipper goes, I go on, and I'm kind of giving my long spiel about what I look at for a pitcher. And all of a sudden, I felt something warm on my leg. And I looked down, and Greg Maddux was peeing on my leg. And Chipper, you know, looks back and laughs and said that was kind of Greg's way of saying, yeah, you know, you're going to be really good, and you're going to be a superstar, but right now, you know, you're still a rookie. And so you hear, know your place. So one of my favorite stories that Chipper tells, he told it on the podcast, I believe, earlier in the year. So one of my favorite Chipper Jones stories. So that's topic one for today. Topic two we'll get to in a second, and I actually did this topic two on the Robin Conrad show last night. Unfortunately, the audio of that is not great, and that goes back to my laptop problems. Rob and I do the podcast from separate locations, and so the internet connection is a big deal. And my old laptop I'm on right now is not quite as fast as the new laptop, obviously, and so I haven't listened to it yet, but I was told the sound for that is not that great. So, but topic two deals with Trevor Hoffman, and let me first say this: Trevor Hoffman's a great guy. Trevor Hoffman is a baseball family. His older brother Glenn Hoffman played for the Red Sox. Trevor Hoffman is big in charities. He's the ideal role model. All those things. So I want to say that first before it sounds like I'm being mean to him, okay? Because I don't want to be mean to him. But I just have a problem with Trevor Hoffman being in the Hall of Fame for a couple reasons, okay? The first reason is he's going in as a pitcher. And I know he's a closer and that's his, all this stuff here. But the bottom line is he's a pitcher, okay? And his role was a closer. Okay, his role as a closer happened because he wasn't good enough to be a starting pitcher. Nobody really kind of grooms you to be a closer. I guess they're starting to do it now. But usually if you're going to be a closer, you're doing it because you lack the secondary pitches. You don't have a secondary pitch to go to. You have maybe one dominant pitch. Maybe nowadays you just throw hard. And, you know, you're lacking all the stuff you need to be a starting pitcher to get through a lineup. Okay? And so that's my first problem with that. And I have an issue with guys like Curt Schilling and Mike Mussina not getting in the Hall of Fame, but Trevor Hoffman getting in the Hall of Fame. Now, listen, I don't think Schilling is a slam dunk for the Hall of Fame. I don't think Mike Mussina is a slam dunk for the Hall of Fame. I think you can make a case for them and against them pretty easily and pretty convincing case either way. And I could buy either way on that. My problem is both of those guys are much better pitchers than Trevor Hoffman. It's not close. Trevor Hoffman's job as a closer is much easier than it is to be a starting pitcher. Much easier. And the reason why that is because if he was a good starting pitcher, he would be in there. Trevor Hoffman could not be a starting pitcher. He doesn't have the pitches to do so. And so I just have an issue with someone who's not good enough to do that is now, you know, in the Hall of Fame. And I'll give you some examples here, too. If you look at the career of John Smoltz and Dennis Eckersley, these are two guys who were starting pitchers and closers. Now, Eckersley was a very good starting pitcher, okay? An all-star type starting pitcher, okay? Won a Cy Young Award, I think, in 78. I believe he won in 78. Greg Gidger won that year. But he's won some 20-game in 78. 20-game winner in 78. And he went to the bullpen, okay? And he had a drinking problem and so forth. And he went to the bullpen with the A's to kind of, recreate his career. And as a closer, he became unhittable. Unhittable. And why is that? Well, because now, as a closer, you can go ahead and you can work off your best pitch, okay? You can go ahead and empty your tank for one inning. And usually you're coming into games, too, with a lead. Most of the time, a two-run lead or a three-run lead. I mean, sometimes a one-run lead. And you're coming in there. You're going to be aggressive. Because even if you make a mistake and the guy hits a home run, you're still leading the game. You're coming in as a closer with the bases empty to start an inning. Everything is set up to go ahead and make it easier. And you're dominant. John Smoltz, very good starting pitcher. Became a closer for basically because he had some arm issues coming back from surgery. He thought it'd be better for his arm, and it helped the team out as well. He was trying to help the team out. Came back, and he was unhittable as a closer. Unhittable. Excuse me. And you look at Jonathan Papelbon when he came for the Red Sox. He came up with the Red Sox as a starting pitcher. And there was big debate. We used him as a starter or as a closer. As a starting pitcher, he was pretty average, okay? He couldn't throw quite as hard. He didn't have quite the same command. And, you know, he wasn't as dominant. They decided to make him a closer, and he was one of the best closers in the game. You see this all the time. Daniel Bard, okay, who wasn't a closer for the Red Sox. He was an eighth inning guy. He had some arm problems, though, too, but he wanted to be a starting pitcher, and he couldn't quite get to that point. You know, you look at Andrew Miller. Andrew Miller couldn't make it as a starting pitcher, and now he's a relief pitcher, and he's thriving. It's just easier. You never see a situation where a guy who struggles as a closer, a relief pitcher, become a starting pitcher and dominate. But you see it all the time the other way. It just bothers me in those things. And it comes back to the idea. And I know why Trevor Hoffman's in the Hall of Fame. Okay, I understand it. He has 601 saves, second most of all time. And so you see that and you feel like you have to vote for him. And so I get that. And that's really a problem of the save stat. Okay, I never quite understood the idea of the save stat. The save stat is just a junk stat. It doesn't tell you anything. Because you're telling me right now that you get a save. You come into a game with the bases loaded, okay, and nobody out with a one-run lead, and you go ahead and get the three guys out, that's a save, right? If you come to the ninth inning with no one on base and a three-run lead and get the three guys out or give up two runs, you might give up two runs and get the third guy out, you get the save. They both count as one save. I mean, there's something ridiculous about that. I mean, they have to. It's just awful. And plus, managers now use their closers in the worst way because they have to use them that way because closers get paid based on their saves. And so you set them up. You don't bring them in the tie games. You don't bring them in the eighth inning or the seventh inning when guys are on base and the best hitter is up there. No, you save them for the ninth inning when you have a lead only and a clean inning when no one's on base because that's how you get saves, how they get paid. You know, Jason Stark brought this up, I believe, last year. So I'm going to give him credit for this idea. He brought this up, and I've kind of thought about it more in depth. But he wants to go to a point system for relievers. Instead of having saves, there's a point system. And so that way you can kind of really judge a reliever. And so the point system will work like this. And not all the details are ironed out. But basically the idea would be if you come into a game, for each hitter you get out, you get a point. If you come into the game and there's guys on base, okay, inherited runners, they keep this stat too. But, you know, it's one of those stats that you don't have to kind of look for a little bit. But you come in and say you got three men on base. And you have to get one guy out. Say there's two outs in the inning and there's three men on base, okay? Well, you come in and you get the guy out. Okay, so you get the guy out. You get 1 point for getting the guy out. And then you get 3 more points for each guy you left stranded on base that you inherited. So right there would be a 4-point kind of on your relief pitcher stats. You get 4 points right there. And so you do that based on that. And if you start doing it that way, and all of a sudden now relievers get paid based on how many points they have in a season, you're going to start using your best reliever in those situations. You're not going to wait when you have a 3-run lead in the 9th inning to use them, because it makes no sense to use them that way, because now that's not the best time to use them, and plus you're not going to get the most points, okay, for that pitcher to help his contract. And so you're going to use a guy like a Mariano Rivera or a Craig Kimbrell. You're going to use them earlier in the game. You're going to use them in the 8th inning or the 7th inning when there's 2 men on base and the best hitter, you know, comes up. You know, when, you know, Manny Machado comes up for the Orioles and there's two guys on base and the Red Sox have a 1-run lead in the 7th inning. Well, you know what? What are you waiting for? That's when you bring in Craig Kimbrell. You bring him in then because the game is really in the balance then. And so, and it doesn't matter, you're not worried about his stats, you're not worried about his save numbers for his contract, because you bring him in, and he's going to get some points if he gets those guys out. And so, that's kind of how the go-to. I think that's how you do that. And I can tell you this, if they did that for Trevor Hoffman, I don't think Trevor Hoffman's numbers would be as impressive. Because, you know, can you remember a save he had that was memorable? Can you remember a big moment in those things? And he just can't, you know. Now, next year, Mariano Rivera goes in the Hall of Fame, and he'll go in. And, you know, I don't have as much of a problem with that. I still bother me a little bit because I still go back to the whole idea that he really wasn't good enough to be a starting pitcher. He came up a starting pitcher. He just didn't have the secondary pitches. Now, maybe he develops them. Maybe he starts off as a number 5 guy and develops them. But does he ever make the Hall of Fame? Does he ever become a dominant starting pitcher? Probably not. And so, once again, he goes into the bullpen, and because the way he pitches is built for that role, he dominates. Now, I don't have as much of a problem just because from the fact that the Hall of Fame has the word fame in it, okay? And it's hard to write the history of baseball without, you know, putting Rivera's name in there somewhere. So him getting in isn't a problem. I think if you're the best ever at something that you do, the best ever closer, I think you get in. But all these other closers who are you know, knocking the door now, I don't think they get in. I don't think they measure up. I think the standard now is going to be Rivera. I think if you're going to get in the Hall of Fame as a relief pitcher, you have to be as good as Rivera was. And that will kind of thin out the field. And there might be a guy that comes around 20 years from now or that is as good as Rivera, and then maybe you give him the nod. But just the standard closer, the all-star closer, the closer who's been an all-star like 10 times, I don't think that it does it necessarily. I don't think because he racks up all these saves does it. I don't think it tells the whole story. So that's my kind of my pet peeve with the whole Hoffman thing. I just don't understand and don't see it. So other Hall of Famers, we had Jim Thome getting in, well-deserved. Vladimir Guerrero, this kind of just happened as I was looking on Twitter just now. Guerrero tweeted out that he has decided he's going to go in as an Angel and not as an Expo. And, of course, lots of backlash. The Expo fans are not happy. And I'm trying to get clarification on this. I thought that the Hall of Fame or MLB or whoever's in charge made the decision for you over what hat you to put on your plaque. And they did that because there used to be a deal where, for example, you know, Wade Boggs, apparently, when he signed with the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, part of the deal was that he would go in the Hall of Fame wearing their cap. And baseball said, no, we can't have that because that's kind of stupid that Wade Boggs is not, you know, going in the Hall of Fame as a Devil Ray because he didn't, you know, all those things. So I think what they do now, I think the rule is the player will kind of, you know, let them know what he'd like to go into. And the Hall of Fame, whoever makes the decision, I think they honor that for the most part, unless it's something ridiculous. And so, and they tell you otherwise. So Guerrero is an interesting case. I think he chose the Angels. I think the Hall of Fame approved it because you can make a case that, you know, he had a great career with the Angels. He won his only MVP there and was in a ton of playoff games there. But So I can see why they approved it. But personally, I mean, when I think of Vladimir Guerrero, I think of him in an Expo uniform. I think of the young Guerrero, the athletic Guerrero, the guy with speed, the arm, all those things. And with the Angels, he was kind of more, he played the outfield, did a lot of DH, he was older. I just think that if you're baseball or the ones in charge, I think you got to take this over. I mean, the player can request something, but I really think that you got to go with what people kind of think of the guy. And when you close your eyes and think of Guerrero, you think of him as an Expo. I mean, at least I do, and I think most baseball people do. So that's something to kind of look into, and one thing that was kind of strange on that. So that's topic two for the night. And before we get to topic three, I want you guys also to check out a site that I also run. And I just kind of started it off a little bit. And it deals with Out of the Park Baseball again, which is a simulation engine, which is really unreal. And we're going to have Out of the Park Baseball announcements coming up here soon on the podcast. We'll have an interview with, I'm trying to get Marcus on the podcast. I did an interview with Marcus in my blog years ago. Marcus is the guy who made Out of the Park Baseball, created it. He's from Germany. And so I'd like to get Marcus on to preview the new game, Out of the Park Baseball 19, which will come out this spring. And I always do a preview blog post about it. But now with the podcast up and running, I'll have someone on from Out of the Park Baseball. It could be one of their PR people or so forth. But I'm going to try to get Marcus on. I'm going to try to start working that angle now to get Marcus on. And since, you know, we'll see if that happens. But anyway, so retrobaseball.net is the new site. And what this is, I like doing the blog post on the pesky.net Out of the Park Baseball, and I do some simulation replay season for the Red Sox on there. But I wanted to create a website where it was all Out of the Park Baseball, and it was a recreation of history. And so what I've done is gone back to 1939, which, as you know, 39 is a historic season because Ted Williams was a rookie that year. And we're going to go ahead and play out history. And so I am the Red Sox GM, and so we're going to play by 1939 rules. There is no free agency, and so, first of all, not really financials are in the game. And, of course, instead of there's no draft. And so, since there's no draft, what we'll do is that the players who make their debut will debut with their actual teams. And so, along those lines. So, as we go forward, you know, when we get to the 60s, and we'll have a draft, okay, and we'll start having a draft where guys can, you can draft players, and so then history will probably take a little bit more of a turn that way. And of course, we get into the 70s, we'll have free agency and all those things there too. But we're going to kind of play along as history goes on and kind of see what happens, what trades happen, all those things. I'll run the Red Sox so I can make some moves, and of course, the Red Sox were notorious back then for not having enough pitching, all kinds of offense, not enough pitching. And so I'm going to try to kind of help out the Red Sox a little bit and make some moves, maybe to acquire more pitching and try to make a run at those Yankees, who will be loaded, of course, with all their great teams coming up. So check it out at retrobaseball.net. And there's several posts up there right now that you can check up. We've played about a week or so into the season, and of course we're delaying that right now because the old laptop is broken. We'll get that back, but there's plenty of articles up there. And what I love too is using the face gen pictures of the Out of the Park Baseball. They're in their old style uniforms, that they have the great pictures, looks just like them, and you can see all kinds of stuff there. But the great ball caps from that era are on there too. So check it out, Retro Baseball .net, and enjoy that. I'm having a lot of fun with that this baseball season and beyond. So definitely check that out. All right, topic three is the pitch clock. Major League Baseball right now is in talks with the Players Association to put a pitch clock in games to speed up the game. And lots of people who are baseball purists, and I consider myself a baseball purist, are upset and don't want this to happen. And let me just kind of explain something to you from my experience. I know what you're talking about, okay? I felt the same way 5 years ago. I felt, don't do this. That's not how baseball is. Baseball doesn't have a clock. That's the beauty of the game. Yada, yada, yada. Well, here's the thing. I live in a college town. I live in Columbia, South Carolina. I go to Gamecock baseball games religiously. And, of course, a couple of years ago, I think it's been 2 years now, I don't even know because this point I want to make here, the college baseball started the pitch clock. And I never forget going to the first game thinking, man, this is going to be stupid. And you don't even notice it. You do not even notice it. The game does not change. The only thing that changes is the fact the game moves along a little bit quicker. And if you really are an old school baseball guy, and say, for example, I liked how baseball was played in the 80s, okay? I thought the pace of play was perfect. I thought the offense, the balance of offense and defense was perfect, all those things in the 80s. And so if you want baseball to be more like the 80s, then you want the game to have that pace. And so if the players won't do it, then you have to artificially make them do it. And having a pitch clock helps them do that. And the pitch clock, you are not even going to notice it. You won't look at it. I think I looked at it for the first inning or two of the first game and then forgot about it. And now, I even forget now that there's a pitch clock in the games I go to. People remind me, oh yeah, that's right, college baseball has one. And I go to about 25 college baseball games a year. And so I forget sometimes they have it there, but I know the games move along a lot quicker than Major League Baseball games do. They're also talking about the idea of the mound visits. And this one, you know, thank God. You know, Gary Sanchez is the worst at this. He goes to the mound, I mean, all the time. And watching a Yankee game at times can be absolutely horrible in terms of the pace of play. And so their new rule they're proposing, I think it's a perfect rule, is you only get one mound visit per pitcher per inning, just like the rules for managers. So it's the same rule. It doesn't matter who goes out to the mound, okay, whether it be the manager, the catcher, the third baseman, whoever it is, that counts as a visit. If you go out there again in that inning with that pitcher, you have to make a pitching change. So I hope that goes through. And understand something, though, too. The reason why that's happening, the reason why Gary Sanchez goes out there all the time, goes back to the idea of sign stealing, okay? Baseball, we found out from the whole Red Sox kind of scandal thing with the old Apple Watch and all this stuff that happened, was that teams are stealing signs at a rapid rate. And so Gary Sanchez and most catchers go out there so often to keep on changing up the signs because they're afraid, they're paranoid, they're being stolen. Okay, so that's one of the reasons they do that. But I think they got to cut that out. One visit per pitcher per inning, that will help. The pitch clock will help. I think the other rule they need to make is that once you're in the batter's box, as a batter, you cannot leave the batter's box, okay? I mean, obviously, if you have a foul ball, I'm not talking about that. But you can't get in there, and there is no more calling time. There is no more, you know, put my hand up, let me go step out of the batter's box for a second and adjust myself. No, you step in the box, okay, you don't get out of the box. And because if you watch old-time baseball, like 19, there's a great YouTube clip of the Red Sox and Minnesota Twins from 1967 during the Red Sox pennant chase there, Impossible Dream. Watch that game. Watch that game. The hitters get in the batter's box. They stay in the box. They don't sit there and do all these stuff they do in the, you know, the whole thing. They get in there and they get out, and that's the end of it. Okay, so I really think you have to get back to that. And all these, you know, and purists will say, I don't like all these rules, but all these rules we're doing is getting the game back to where it was. Okay, unfortunately, we have to artificially do it right now because of this idea. But my rule is this. There is no getting out of the batter's box. You get out of the batter's box, the pitcher, you keep on pitching. Okay, you're not ready. And you call the pitch a ball or a strike. You know, that's too bad. So hopefully, they'll put the rule in with the mound visits, the pitch clock, and they'll make that rule there. I think that last rule, though, will probably be a hard one to pass. But I think they got to make it. They got to make it, and that will make baseball move along a little bit quicker. It's not about the whole length of game either. It's not about length of game. I'll take a good 4-hour baseball game, okay? But how's the pace? Am I sitting there waiting a minute and a half before each pitch? I mean, no one wants to do that. So the whole idea is to get more action, get to the action quicker, okay? The length of game is not the issue on that either. Interesting enough, David Ortiz, who was the ultimate guy in terms of stepping out of the batter's box, spitting into his gloves, the whole thing, and taking his sweet time, who was against the pitch clock when he played, so it was a horrible idea. He's now changed his tune. Now, suddenly, David Ortiz thinks that the pitch clock is a good idea. So it's amazing what happens once you get out of the game and you're not affected personally. Suddenly you can kind of see the light on that. So that's David Ortiz's stance now on that. So interesting take on that. Let me go ahead and get to the next one. Let me take a little sip of water here. My throat is getting dried up, my friends. Dried up throat. Ah, tastes good. All right. Fourth topic there. Tim Tebow. Tim Tebow is in the news again this week. And background story. So one of the cool things about having a blog, and I've been having this baseball blog for a while. I did some freelance work on some baseball sites, that I can get a media pass to most minor league baseball games. And we have a local team here in town. Their first year was last year. The first year was 2 years ago. I'm losing my mind. The Columbia Fireflies, and I get media passes to Firefly games, and I appreciate the Fireflies who give me access. And we're working on trying to get Kevin Fitzgerald on. Kevin Fitzgerald is the play-by-play for the Fireflies, and he's a Syracuse alum, and he's been working on ESPN some games as well. So we're going to get him on as well here soon, hopefully. We're efforting that as we speak. So last year, the big year was Tim Tebow made his pro debut and ended up in Columbia, and it was crazy. It was crazy. Opening night, the press room in the conference room was packed with media. You know, I was in there. It was really cool to see. You saw people from national outlets there, the whole deal. And, of course, Tim Tebow went ahead and hit a home run in his first at-bat, which is unreal. I got it on a video. You can check it out on YouTube page. It's on there. And afterwards, he interviewed the whole thing. And, you know, and here's the thing with Tebow. You can have your opinion on Tebow. If he's a phony, he's, you know, not really this. He shouldn't be playing baseball. It is hard, though, to actually have contact with him and not come away being impressed with him. I asked him a question in the press conference, and he answered the question and looked right at me like he was, I'm the only guy in the room and having a conversation with me. And he just has that way of connecting to people. Before he came into the press room after the game, the press room is right next to the Firefly locker room. So you can kind of hear a lot going on. And you could hear before he came in his teammates chanting, Tebow, Tebow, and yelling and screaming. And just, you know, he'd been on the team, you know, less than a month. And it was the first game, but he was in spring training. He was with his team for a couple weeks. And already he had won them over. Like, they already liked him. And I bring this up because when I first got to the first game, we were out in the field. They were playing the Augusta Green Jackets. And this horde of media, media, they're on the field waiting for Tim Tebow to come out of the clubhouse and down the dugout steps. And so we're waiting and we're looking in there. And meanwhile, you have Augusta Green Jacket players coming out. You know, we're kind of looking, okay, that's not Tebow. That's an Augusta guy. And so this one player kind of walked out and then stood by me shoulder to shoulder, kind of put his arm around me a little bit, and kind of peered in like I was. He goes, who we looking for? You know, kind of being sarcastic. He knew who we were looking for. And I go, this guy named Tebow. Oh, yeah, of course. And he kind of had that attitude of, you know, what a joke this is, you know, a farce this is, and so forth. And, of course, he wasn't Tim Tebow's teammate, and that's kind of how he felt. Well, you know, this week it broke that the New York Mets are going to invite Tim Tebow to their Major League camp in the spring. And reports came out that several players in the Mets organization, didn't name names, were just absolutely furious about that. That he didn't earn his way there, you know, that he's only doing it because he's Tim Tebow, and very upset. And I actually tweeted the guy who broke the story and asked him if he could tell me if any of them were, because he said guys in the organization, so it could be guys, you know, AAA, AA, single A, it could be guys in the Fireflies and all that stuff. But I asked him if there, any of them played with Tebow last year as a teammate who said that. And I never got an answer back, but here's my guess. I am guessing the people who are upset are people who don't know Tim Tebow and people who didn't play with him. And I'm not saying that they're not right, by the way. You know, you can sit there and make a good case that he should not get that invite. He hasn't earned it, okay? My point is, though, if you don't play with him or get to know him, I think it's easier to kind of bash him. I think the guys in the Fireflies, even though they might feel, yeah, I'm not sure he deserves it, the fact that I think they all really have this respect for him, for the kind of person he is and team that he is and how hard he works, I don't think any of those guys would have said that even off the record feeling that way. So that's one thing to kind of watch for and look at on that. But, you know, it was a crazy year following Tim Tebow in Columbia and just watching him play every day, the crowd, the opponents. I went to a couple of road games and how, you know, the opponent players treated him. The Greenville Drive, of course, got a little Twitter war with the Columbia Fireflies kind of mocking Tebow. So it was an interesting year. I really want to get Kevin Fitzgerald on, who was the play-by-play guy of the Fireflies, to kind of talk to him kind of about that year and kind of the things that he went through. Because, you know, Kevin also works as the media director, relations guy, so he's the one that kind of fulfills the credential requests and all those things. And so I am sure last year was a year like he never experienced in terms of the requests he was getting and the media time and all these media rules they had for Tebow, because everyone wanted a piece of him. And so hopefully we'll get Kevin on here soon to talk about that. Last topic, not really a topic, kind of a sad story. But Field of Dreams in Dyersville, Iowa. The actual field where they filmed the movie. I've not been there yet. It's a bucket list thing, though, for me. Apparently some guy got into a truck and went and drove all over the field and did, you know, the skids and the burnouts, and the field was wet and basically vandalized the field with big tire marks. So not a good day for the people who own that, who rely on tourists to come out there and see it and pay money and so forth. But who in the world would do that? Like, what person decides that they're going to screw up that field? That's got to be a person who must hate baseball. You can't love baseball and do that. There's no way you can love baseball and then go to the Field of Dreams field, the movie set field, and do that. There is no way you can do that. I want to find out who the guy is and find out what his deal is. But that's just awful news out there. Hopefully they'll get it fixed up. And hopefully, you know, the damage wasn't too bad. But just a kind of a weird story today coming out on the wire about that. So that's about it for the Pesky Pole podcast. We're going to have some guests on here soon. Check me out at thepeskypole.net. Hopefully my new laptop, my old laptop, will be fixed here soon. So we'll get back to some 1988 baseball, Red Sox baseball, on thepeskypole.net. And remember, watch the or look for the Robin Comrade show. You can look for that at robinconrad.com or the Apple Store, iTunes Store, I should say. And that podcast is up. We do a show on Wednesday and Sunday nights. And we're going to have Aaron Fitt on here soon to interview him about college baseball. So if you like college baseball and want to get a preview of college baseball, to check that out. I'm going to try having Aaron on this podcast later in the year when it gets close to draft time, or probably after draft time. And if the Red Sox go ahead and draft some college players, I like getting Aaron's perspective on those players that get drafted out of college, that he can kind of talk about their makeup in college. So look for that as well. And that's it for now. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends, and check me out at thepeskypole.net or on Twitter at thepeskypole. Have a great night.